From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, recruiting men and women who want to join the wartime military and counseling men and women who want to get out. We talk with Air Force recruiter Sergeant Reginald Bullock, and we meet Jim Crichton, who counsels conscientious objectors. Also, Middle East scholar Charles Tripp tells us what we can learn from looking at Iraq's previous war. And media critic John Leonard talks with us about the experience of watching the war on TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli radio is reporting tonight that 3 people died and at least 70 were wounded in an Iraqi Scud missile attack in which one Scud apparently slipped through U.S. anti-missile defenses. Army officials said the missile damaged at least 20 apartment buildings in a densely populated area of Tel Aviv. Brigadier General Nachman Shai said that the U.S. Army's Patriot missile batteries fired at least 2 missiles at the incoming Scud, but failed to intercept it. Israel had warned earlier that it would retaliate if it were attacked again. The latest word from the Pentagon is that the Allied air offensive against Iraq has intensified, but Saddam Hussein's air force is not coming out to fight. NPR's David Malpas has more from the Pentagon.
If Saddam Hussein is pulling his punches, waiting for a later stage in the war to go on the offensive, that's a poor strategy, according to Pentagon Operations Director General Thomas Kelly. Kelly says Hussein is taking steady losses, and we aren't going to run out of bombs and missiles. Allied officials say 50% to 80% of Iraq's air force may remain intact in shelters in northern Iraq. But so far, they haven't been much of a factor, nor has Iraq's Navy. 2 Iraqi ships were disabled today. No additional American casualties have been reported. I'm David Malpas at the Pentagon.
This morning, there was a demonstration in front of the American embassy in the Jordanian capital, Amman. A crowd of mostly women and children gathered to condemn United States policy in the Middle East. The BBC's Hugh Schofield reports from Amman, Jordan.
More than 200 people assembled opposite the American embassy in the fashionable Jebel Amman quarter to vent their anger against the Allied attacks on Iraq. Placards denounced President Bush and the Israelis and called for linkage between the 2 occupations of Kuwait and the West Bank and Gaza. Many people carried posters of the local hero here, Saddam Hussein.
He's the only person who had the chance to have enough arms to fight. Not just America, to fight the world.
Given the depth of feeling for Saddam Hussein here, it's surprising that today's demonstration, itself small, was in fact the first since war broke out.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield. The Philippine government has ordered the expulsion of Iraq's consul general for his alleged connection with an attempted bombing over the weekend. Philippine intelligence agents charged that the Iraqi official personally supervised the attempt to bomb a U.S. government library in Manila. The attempt failed when the bomb evidently exploded prematurely, killing an Iraqi national and wounding his companion. Philippine intelligence sources said that the car used in the bombing belonged to the Iraqi consul general and that he was in the car when the other men attempted to plant the bomb. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost 26 points today to close at 2,600.03. This is NPR News. U.S. military officials in Saudi Arabia say that Iraq has blown up several oil wells and storage tanks in southern Kuwait. A spokesman said that aerial photography showed that the fires in Kuwait's Al Wafra oil field in a so-called neutral zone on the Saudi border. A Persian Gulf oil industry source said fuel storage tanks are burning out of control at 2 of Kuwait's 3 oil refineries on the coast. News of the fire sent oil prices up again. Crude oil for February delivery closed up almost $3 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Concern over the possibility of terrorist attacks is taking a toll on air travel. Airlines are cutting back on flight schedules and passengers are canceling their reservations. Those who do fly find themselves subject to unprecedented security checks. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Berlin.
Flying in Europe has always meant putting up with stringent security, but never have the measures been as tight as they are these days. Here in Germany, airport authorities are now prohibiting airline passengers from traveling with electrical appliances. No laptop computers, radios, hair dryers, electric razors, nothing, according to the latest government regulations, that could contain a bomb. Such electrical products are confiscated from passengers at check-in time. They're either held at the airport until passengers return to pick them up, or the appliances may be shipped on separately 1 or 2 days later after they have been left in a special storage room to make sure they don't explode at high altitude conditions. The new policy has left many travelers angry, but officials here say the measures are necessary to avoid another disaster like the Pan Am bombing in 1988. In Berlin, I'm Tom Jolton.
French officials said today that they've decided to expel 18 more Arabs as a potential danger to public order. Most of those arrested were Iraqis, but police said that some Moroccans and Algerians were also in custody. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we watch today's missile hit in Tel Aviv and the videotapes of bruised and shaken American prisoners of war interrogated by their captors, some Americans feel more strongly than ever that Iraqi aggression must be stopped. Other Americans are strengthened in their conviction that this war should not have been fought. My two guests work at the gates that lead into and out of the American military. Sergeant Reginald Bullock is an Air Force recruiter. Jim Crichton is a conscientious objector who counsels people who want to get discharged from the military. In the next half hour, we'll hear how each of them is counseling men and women today. First, Jim Crichton. He's been counseling conscientious objectors for 12 years. He's on the board of the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors, and he does military counseling for the Quaker group, the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting of Friends. He told me the definition of a conscientious objector.
A conscientious objector is a person who, because of religious, moral, or ethical beliefs, cannot participate in war in any form. And war in any form should be read in any war. A person who would pick or choose the war in which they would fight would be considered a selective objector. And the legal and regulatory definition of conscientious objector does not include selective objectors. It specifically precludes them. The religious, moral, or ethical belief must be a belief that's a central guiding force in a person's life.
I think a lot of Americans have a hard time understanding how somebody who signed up to be in the military, signed up to be in the reserves, can, when war breaks out, decide that now they're a conscientious objector. You've been meeting people who are already in the military and want CO status. Can you describe some of their thinking behind that?
Absolutely. For any conscientious objector within the armed forces, the fact that they are conscientious objectors is a change. When they entered the armed forces and signed an enlistment agreement or accepted a commission, they signed a paper that said, "I am not a conscientious objector." And one of the reasons that in a situation like this, so many people do have a change in what they believe is that human nature works that way. When we're faced with a situation that makes us think very carefully about an important moral decision, a lot of times we come to new understandings. That's true with people who are thinking about preservation of life versus quality of life, who have an aging parent, the quality of whose life has deteriorated because of their health, as they think about the issue of euthanasia. Anytime that a large change in someone's lifestyle or a major issue comes up, people do reevaluate and they do change their mind. And that's happening with a lot of people now as they look very carefully at what the war means.
You're on your way to Fort Dix later today. What will you be doing there?
I'll be returning there with a conscientious objector who will be returning to the Army after a period of absence. His situation is that he became a conscientious objector early on in the current Gulf crisis before the outbreak of war, and he attempted to submit an application for conscientious objector status. His command refused to accept the application, And when they finally did actually take it in hand, they refused to process it, saying that he had to report with his unit to Saudi Arabia before they would even consider his claim. His beliefs would not permit him to do that, being present to even performing support roles there in the Saudi desert would have just flagrantly violated his beliefs, and he felt that it simply was not acceptable. He sought remedy in federal district court. His petition was denied, and he felt that the only possible remedy for him in keeping with his conscience was to leave, and he'll be returning now to resolve his situation with the Army. Hopefully the Army will see fit to discharge him administratively now.
Now, is this typical of what's happening now? People who are in the military who are trying to file for conscientious objector status are being told that they have to report first? Like, if they've been assigned to report to the Gulf, they have to go there first before their application will be processed?
That's been a problem, particularly with the Army, and there have been at least 150, probably more, people who have attempted to submit applications and have been told that they have to wait till they arrive at their permanent duty station, which will be Saudi Arabia, before they can file. And although some of those people have gone to Saudi Arabia and filed their claims there, many of them simply have not in good conscience been able to do so. And so there are a large number of people who have left the Army without authorization because they needed to do that to keep with their conscience.
And what are they doing, leaving the country and living in exile?
Well, during Vietnam, that was a major option for people. There really aren't other countries that are willing to take U.S. military members now. And so, for the most part, they are in the country where they've been at the time that they've started their absence. And they're waiting for an opportunity to resolve their army situation without being sent to the Persian Gulf and being forced to perform duties their consciences won't permit them to.
Are they in hiding in this country, or are they just waiting for more contact with the military?
In some instances, people are in hiding. In other instances, people have sought sanctuary in churches that are offering sanctuary to war resistors. In other instances, people have been quite public about their whereabouts and their position. And in other instances where people have been stationed in other countries, they're still in those countries.
Have you met a lot of people in the military who feel that they were misled by their recruiter?
Absolutely. This comes up in a large percentage of our interviews with our clients. Of course, to a certain extent, our clientele is a selected population, but still, the percentage of my clients who talk about being misled at some point in the recruitment process is extremely large. And there are also regular stories about people sitting around in basic training, going around the circle and each person telling what their recruiter told them, and then everyone gets a laugh out of it because it's so much different from the situation they're actually encountering.
Can you give us some examples of ways people feel they were misled by recruiters?
Well, one of the major areas where that's happening now is in terms of guaranteed schooling and guaranteed jobs. The armed forces now are using something called the delayed entry program to get most of their personnel between 80% and 90%. This means that they get people to enlist as much as 365 days before their entrance onto active duty. And this enables them to plan when people will be entering their initial school, so that if they have a particular specialty school and they need a certain number of people in that specialty school, they can plan to have the people available at that school. And so they overbook the school, similar to the way in which airlines overbook their flights to make sure that they'll have a full school, like the airlines want to ensure having a full flight.
So sometimes you're promised a certain school and you'll enlist expecting that school but you won't get it because they've overbooked.
That's right.
How has your life been changed by this war?
Now there are probably literally hundreds of people over there in the Saudi Arabian desert who I've talked with, some of them face to face in my office, and the fact that I have ongoing relationships with their family have just made that war seem very real to me. I find myself falling asleep listening to my shortwave radio, waiting for reports of what's happening. I find myself waiting for the calls from the families.
Jim Crichton, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Jim Crichton is a conscientious objector who does military counseling for the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting of Friends. Coming up, we talk to an Air Force military recruiter. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. Sergeant Reginald Bullock is an Air Force recruiter. He's been a recruiter for 3 years, in the Air Force for 9. But today when he visited our studios, he wasn't wearing his uniform, a precaution against terrorism. We've seen on television how astounding some of the Air Force high-tech weapons are. In fact, many people have compared the targeting systems to video games. I wondered if this amazing technology has been getting people to call recruiters wanting to sign up.
Not necessarily. I believe that in Philadelphia, because of the density of the population and the type of information that can be disseminated with that amount of people, most people in our area are more informed than, say, in a suburban area where you only talk to few people. So although they see the technology and they see the different high techs, they're still in tune with what war is really about. They have their uncles, they have their fathers, they have their relatives who may have been a part of Vietnam. They have their mothers and aunts who may have lost a boyfriend or husband or someone of that nature in Vietnam. So at that same token, it balances out from information standpoint, and that would bring them back to reality.
Are you getting more or less people signing up since the outbreak of war?
A lot less. Again, the reality of war has hit home in Philadelphia with the recruits. Far as our office and also other branches of services concerned, we've had a significant decrease. And they're hesitant. They're apprehensive. Recruiters will call the house, and the mothers and fathers will ask us, do you know there's a war going on? And they're scared for their sons and daughters, and rightfully so, I guess.
How has what you tell people as a recruiter changed since the beginning of the Gulf crisis and now since the outbreak of war?
Well, we are salesmen as recruiters, and we'll tell them, you're coming into the Air Force, and there are several things that you may be coming in for: money, advancement, training, recreation, satisfaction, security, to get out of Philadelphia, to go back to college, things of that nature. Now, because I pride myself on not lying to the applicants, I find it difficult in choosing the words to say without telling them something that may not materialize. I used to tell applicants that the chances of you going to war are slim to none within the first year because of the basic training time, the technical training time, and then the on-the-job training time necessary to get an individual proficient before he can actually do that job. And I've since heard otherwise. I've heard of applicants that are going to the Gulf from tech school. So I had to stop saying that based on the new information. And so what I'm telling them is the reality of war, and also I'm telling them that they do have a chance of being stationed in the Gulf. However, from a patriotic standpoint, a lot of applicants who are not familiar with the past, I kind of give them a little history of what the United States flag stands for, what my position as a recruiter and a Air Force personnel and Department of Defense personnel's position is, and how the United States has maintained its freedom. And so in that respect, I am more or less selling the Air Force from a patriotic standpoint as opposed to what we can do for them. It's no longer just that. It's now what we need for you to do for us as a country in order to stay viable.
This is the first time, I imagine, that anyone you've recruited is actually going to be in battle.
Yes.
What kind of responsibility does that bring to you? What kind of change of feelings, if any, have you found yourself having about the work since the war?
And, you know, I initially came back to Philadelphia. I'm a native Philadelphian. And I came back to help a lot of young individuals out, get them jobs, and basically give them some of the opportunities that I've had to go to school and to learn and to get a cultural background and experience and just grow. And now the reality of what's going on now can stifle that. And so there's a chance that someone may go over there in the Gulf that I put in and may not come back. And that's something that I'm going to have to live with. And so there are a lot of deep thoughts rolling through my head about that. But at the same time, you know, I am a sergeant. I've been trained for this. And I know what our job is and our position is. And I, too, am also in a position that I may go over there. So if they were to go over there and serve their country and become a casualty in battle, that's part of the job. It's a gruesome part of the job that, you know, many of us don't like to talk about or even think about, for that matter. But it is a reality. Hopefully it won't happen to anybody that I put in. But if it should, then that's something that I'm going to have to live with.
What would bring you over to the Gulf?
I'm an aircraft armament systems specialist. My job is rockets, missiles, and bombs, and I'm an expert on the F-15 aircraft. The need would bring me over there. I'm thoroughly trained with what's going on over there. I've trained for chemical warfare. I've trained for exactly what's happening right now. So if someone feels as though my position is necessary over there and to remove me out of recruiting, then that will take me over there.
Sergeant Reginald Bullock is my guest. He's a recruiter with the Air Force. Sergeant Bullock, do you have a quota that you have to fulfill per month or
sure.
per year? Can you give us an idea of what the quota is and if it's changed recently?
The quota is, for me personally, this month, 2. I have to put in 2 people a month. And it has changed because of the budget, the Grand Rudman requirements. We have reduced the amount of people we're putting in. And so instead of Air Force recruiters putting in 4 and 5 people a month, having a quota of that, now our quota has been reduced considerably.
I know that some people in the military have complained that they feel they were misled by a recruiter, mm-hmm. that they were promised a school they didn't get into, or that they were promised their family could accompany them to a foreign base, and then they were later told their family couldn't come, that there weren't enough spots open for that kind of arrangement. What do you hear about that from people who you know? And I wonder if you could be candid about it. What if you feel that there are, in fact, recruiters who do mislead to fulfill their quota?
Sure. I have an old philosophy, and that is that people are people before they're anything else. Before we're in the military, we're human, or men, or women, or people. Before you're a radio announcer, you're still a person. And so your personality is a reflection of you prior to you even having any type of employment. And so therefore, we have all types of people. And I can sit here and honestly say, yes, there are recruiters that probably have told applicants things that were not true and promised them or guaranteed them or whatever you want to call it. You know, the whole thing that you hear about, you know, my recruiter lied to me. That's an old cliche. My recruiter lied to me. That goes on, I'm sure. It doesn't go on in my office, and I make sure that. As a matter of fact, I'll tell any applicant that I will not guarantee or promise you anything. And I usually lay that right on the line when they come into the office, because they'll come in and say, well, the Army said this, and the Army said that, or the Navy said this, and I want to be an air traffic controller, or I want to be a fighter pilot. I said, well, first of all, let's get one thing clear. I cannot guarantee or promise you anything because I am not directly responsible for your career. You are. But if you deal with an applicant from a realistic point of view and explain to him how the system works, you know, and they can see that recruiters have their hands tied also, and you lay everything out, you lay all your cards out on the table, it makes for a better cohesive relationship. But unfortunately, yes, we have recruiters out there that are doing some of those type of practices to meet the quota. And it's pressure. The recruiters are pressured, you know, by their superiors, and they do whatever it takes to make that goal.
We've all watched the tapes on television of the prisoners of war, the tapes that the Iraqis made, and it's just been heartbreaking to watch that. I wonder what effect that's had on you to watch it.
I got upset. First of all, I feel as though that the military way of life and the civilian way of life are two different ways of life. You can't teach a civilian about the military way of life without them being a part of it. All of the individuals that are watching, well, I won't say all, but many of the civilians that are watching that are going through a lot of heartbreak and terror and emotional stress. They're glued to the television, can't get on with their day-to-day life. And then to show this, and the first thing came to my mind is this young man's mother or his wife or his children. Did they authorize that? Did they give it permission? But it hurts for me to see what is going on the television, because I can associate myself with the realities of war. I can see it, I can feel it, everything. I'm just not there, but I feel real in touch with them. And I write letters to some of the guys over there because several hundred individuals over there are my friends. But I really feel bad for the families, and I feel bad because the civilian is being militarized without consent. You know, you didn't choose to join the military. So therefore, for you to have to see all of this stuff, the same stuff these soldiers are going to see, who are going to come back with these psychological effects, it's going to affect you just as well. And you weren't even trained to deal with it.
So you think soldiers see this differently than civilians do?
I do, because we're trained over a period of time and taught how to handle it. And so when we see it, we were expecting it. Civilians see it, and they're like, oh, my God. You know, and that's something.
Sergeant Bullock, do you hope that you will be sent to the Gulf?
No. I'm not going to sit here and say that I wish that I, you know, can go over there. I will say that because I know that I'm trained to do the job over there, if I am called upon to go, oh, yeah, I'll go in a minute, and I won't have any hesitation about going. But I'm not going to jump up and down and raise my hand and say, take me, take me, take me, because I also have a job here in Philadelphia, and should anything happen where we have to beef up the amount of people we have in the military, I'm going to have to do that. So I have two jobs.
Sergeant Bullock, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sergeant Reginald Bullock is an Air Force recruiter in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. To better understand Saddam Hussein's actions in this war, we take a look at his actions in Iraq's previous war. Coming up, a talk with Middle East historian Charles Tripp about the Iran-Iraq war and about the power structure that keeps Saddam Hussein in control. Even though this war is being fought thousands of miles away, we watch it on TV and listen to it on the radio live. We talk with media critic John Leonard about being in the audience for war. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. An Iraqi Scud missile struck Tel Aviv today, apparently getting by the U.S. Patriot anti-missile defense system. Israeli radio says that several people died during the attack and at least 70 were injured. Israeli radio said the three who died were elderly people who had heart attacks. It was the first time that Patriot missiles had been fired inside Israel. Prime Minister Shamir has called a meeting of key cabinet ministers tomorrow to discuss this latest attack, the most serious on Israel since the start of the Persian Gulf War. In Washington, the Bush administration condemned Iraq's latest missile attack against Israel, calling it a brutal act of terror. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The condemnation came in a written statement from the White House. It said that President Bush met with his national security advisors this afternoon, and he received a report from Secretary of State James Baker on Deputy Secretary Lawrence Eagleburger's mission to Israel. Eagleburger will remain in Israel. The statement called the latest Iraqi missile attack, quote, a continued example of Iraq's unprovoked aggression against its neighbors. We condemn this brutal act of terror against innocent civilians, which has caused a number of casualties. Israel has shown remarkable restraint in the face of this aggression, end quote. The statement adds that the White House will continue to consult with the government of Israel. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The cost of the Persian Gulf conflict have been estimated at anywhere between $28 and $86 billion by the Congressional Budget Office. Although it's too early to tell exactly how much the war will cost, there's already a debate on Capitol Hill about how to pay for it. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
There are several ways to pay for the war. There's the pay-as-you-go approach, which could include a one-time war tax. Today, House Speaker Tom Foley said there are no plans to introduce a war tax, but he wouldn't rule out the option completely. When questioned about a war tax at a House Budget Committee hearing today, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan said that a tax should not be necessary unless the war turns into a very long one. Other options would be to offset the cost of the war with spending cuts or to just let the costs add to the national debt, as they are now. Meanwhile, a bill has been introduced to require the White House to report regularly to Congress on the costs of the war and to report about how much of the cost is being borne by our allies. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Soviet President Gorbachev has called for a peaceful solution to the Persian Gulf War before the death toll climbs. In a statement to reporters in Moscow, the Soviet leader said that the events taking place in the Persian Gulf are clearly escalating and that, he said, is very dangerous. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 26 points to close at 2,603.22 on volume of some 176 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News. In Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev has denied any personal involvement in military attacks in Lithuania and Latvia. Speaking at a news conference where he declined to take any questions, the Soviet president said that he was sorry for the loss of life in the military crackdowns and said that circumstances connected with the use of weapons should be investigated. 20 people have died and dozens of others injured in attacks by Soviet commandos in the two Baltic republics. In a statement issued today, the UN Secretary General expressed grave concern over the intensity of the Persian Gulf War. He again urged Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to comply with UN Security Council resolutions and pull out of Kuwait. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The Secretary General said that he has witnessed with profound grief and anxiety the increasing severity of the war and the widening of the area of hostilities. He said Iraq must leave Kuwait to prevent the toll in death and destruction from escalating and to keep the people in the region from suffering anymore. He made no mention of allied forces. Earlier today, Perez de Cuellar told reporters Iraq had clearly violated the Geneva Convention with its treatment of captured Allied pilots. Today's statement was the strongest issued by the Secretary General since the Gulf War began 6 days ago. Perez de Cuellar also said he was in touch with UN agencies and the Red Cross to ensure that humanitarian aid is provided to those hurt by the conflict. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
In Bulgaria, officials say because of severe energy shortages, half of the residents of the country's second-largest city have been without heat for several days. The nation has been hard hit by sharply cut oil deliveries from the Soviet Union and the Persian Gulf crisis, which has driven up oil prices. There is also a lack of hard currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This is America's first war since Vietnam, but the Iraqis just ended an 8-year war with Iran in 1988. It was a war that resulted in more than 1 million casualties. Experts are looking at the Iran-Iraq war for clues to Saddam Hussein's strategy in this war. Charles Tripp is the co-author of Iran and Iraq at War, and he teaches at London University's School of Oriental and African Studies. He spoke with me earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London. I asked him what kind of military training Saddam Hussein has.
He has none. He's promoted himself to the rank of field marshal, but he's never served in the military. The reason he is where he is really at the moment is because, of course, his uncle, General Bakr, was a military man, much trusted within the armed forces, and a great military conspirator. And he came to power, Saddam Hussein came to power, more or less on the coattails, as it were, of his uncle's military political expertise.
Did he get rid of his uncle so he could grab more power himself?
Almost certainly. I think that what one saw, Saddam Hussein became president officially of Iraq in 1979. But really by the early 1970s, by about 1973, Saddam Hussein had more or less eliminated everybody who might be a challenge to him within the Ba'ath Party, which was his main stronghold, and so had become increasingly influential within the regime, trusted by his uncle, the president, and increasingly taking on most of the major responsibilities. By 79, when his uncle was persuaded to resign as president, to retire, he was effective number one. I think there's no doubt about it, the fact that Saddam Hussein persuaded his uncle to retire as president. And there's a strong suspicion that when his uncle died in 1982, this was not a death simply due to natural causes.
How did Saddam Hussein protect himself during the Iran-Iraq war? And what would that lead you to guess about how he's protecting himself now?
Well, how he protected himself politically is one question, and how he protected himself, as it were, physically is another. On the second, I think it's very difficult for me to comment in any detail, simply because I don't know enough. I think that from what one gathers of reports, there is an extraordinarily complex and some would say almost paranoid, but in the Iraqi context, probably quite sensible system of protection of the person of the president. But the political protection is perhaps the more important question. And two things one saw him doing during that war. One was to try and convince all those around him that if he was to fall, they would all fall as well. And this was relatively easy to do while the Iranians were demanding the establishment of an Islamic Republic in Iraq. That is, it was not difficult to persuade the existing elite that the Iranians had no place for them either. But the other way he did it was, of course, a way which he's tried really more or less since his first ascendancy into power, which was to make sure that in most of the trusted positions, he had relatives, kinsmen, members of his clan, members of his tribe, and one or two selected, trusted individuals who are more or less his creatures.
Are there disadvantages of surrounding yourself with family?
Well, yes, I think that one may see it in the case of Saddam Hussein. One, a more specific one, is that obviously if you favour your own family, you tend to exclude all the others, or at least you tend to exclude other clans, other networks, other kin groups. And many of them can begin to resent it. And unless you're very able, the chances are that there will be a kind of coalition of tribes, of clans, of families against you. This is something Saddam Hussein, a danger which he's always had to run, and to some extent he's managed to avoid it. But I think the other question, which has obviously seems to have come up in the light of this crisis, is the fact that when you surround yourself with your kinsmen, your clan, you have around you people whose outlook is more or less exactly the same as your own. So the problem is, if you're trying to judge the outside world's reactions, the larger strategic question, you have nobody sufficiently distanced from that inner circle to be able to give you, as it were, an objective assessment. And I think one may have seen the results of that in this slide into war, which has been taking place since the invasion of Kuwait.
Does Tariq Aziz, who is the Iraqi figure that Americans have seen most of, in addition to Saddam Hussein, does Tariq Aziz fit into the picture that you've drawn us of Saddam Hussein surrounding himself with people from his hometown and from his family?
Well, I think that the great thing about Tariq Aziz is that, of course, he comes from a very small minority community, the Christians, in Iraq, and therefore is no kind of threat to Saddam Hussein. I did not mean to imply that Saddam Hussein has exclusively surrounded himself by his family. He's been quite careful in occasionally promoting people from the Kurdish community, from the Shia community, and Tariq Aziz's case, of course, from the Christian community, as his personal creatures. But I think one of the things one must remark about Tariq Aziz, he would not be where he was today was it not for the patronage of Saddam Hussein. And in that sense, Saddam Hussein can be totally reliant upon him, or believes he can be, because Tariq Aziz has nowhere else to go. He is regarded by his own community as being a creature of Saddam Hussein, by other Iraqis as being not only a creature of Saddam Hussein, but a Christian from a minority who has a power which many Iraqis might resent. And in that sense, he's quite isolated in, if you like, the close embrace of Saddam Hussein himself.
Historian Charles Tripp in a conversation recorded earlier today. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Charles Tripp is my guest, and he teaches at London University's School of Oriental and African Studies. He's also the co-author of a book about the Iran-Iraq War. We've been watching the videotapes of the Americans who were taken prisoner of war by the Iraqis. It's been really horrifying to watch that. What kind of track record did Iraq have in terms of how they treated Iranian prisoners of war during the Iran-Iraq War?
I don't know in detail, but again, one has heard anecdotal evidence for some fairly brutal treatment. Brutal treatment really in a kind of callous way. I don't think necessarily picked out for particular persecution in the sense they say a political prisoner in Iraq would be, but just in the way that they were neglected, not really looked after, not properly treated, until it became important for the Iraqi government to demonstrate its good behavior to the Red Cross. And of course, as the Iraqis increasingly relied on an international effort to support them, that was more and more important. So after 1983, things did tend to get better for the Iranian prisoners. But I think one aspect of the Iranian prisoners, which again has been very important within Iraq, is to display them to the people. And I think perhaps this is the key to what one has seen on Iraqi television. That is, it's no good taking prisoners as far as the Iraqi government is concerned, unless you can show the people of Iraq that you have done so, and you show them in relatively humiliating circumstances. You parade them either in the backs of lorries through the town or on television screens, so to give the people some tangible evidence that their side is winning.
So you think that the tapes really weren't meant for Americans to watch, but rather for Iraqis to see?
Oh, I think there could be a double purpose in this. I think that throughout the crisis, from really August the 2nd, one of the attempts by Saddam Hussein has been to influence opinion in the West, and particularly, of course, to undermine the will to fight. And he's made a great deal of play of that in his propaganda about the fact that the West would never go to war because nobody could possibly sustain the idea of fighting in the West. And I think one saw that in the case of the hostages until he released them. One's seen that in the tone of his propaganda. And quite clearly, I think the display of prisoners speaking in their own language on television is part of this particular belief by Saddam Hussein that it will somehow influence opinion in the West against the war.
You know, one thing we've all been wondering in America is how come Saddam Hussein hasn't deployed the Air Force yet? And I was reading your book on the Iran-Iraq War, and there's a very interesting quote from Saddam Hussein that he made in 1980. He said, "We will not use our Air Force. We will keep it 2 years. Hence, our Air Force will be in a position to pound Bani Sadr and his collaborators." What might that indicate about his strategy today and why he hasn't deployed the Air Force yet?
Well, there might be a parallel in this. I think one has to be quite cautious at the moment because, after all, the war is less than a week old, and one doesn't quite know what the operational or military reasons, although one can guess at them, for the problems of the Air Force. Obviously, in military operational terms, there's the problem of knowing to what extent the Iraqi Air Force can counter the kind of air power which the coalition has deployed over Iraq. There's the problem of the runways. There may even be the problem, for all one knows, of kerosene, of jet fuel, for which there were reported shortages earlier on. But politically, I think there is a couple of interesting points which might be thought of. The first is, rather as in the Iran-Iraq War, the belief that as long as Iraq can withstand the attack, it must have something in reserve with which to produce a victory at the end. And this goes very much, I think, with the mentality almost of the Scud missiles. That is a kind of wonder weapon which will produce a victory out of the unexpected apparent defeat of Iraq. But there's also another reason, which I don't know whether it's the one that plays on his mind at the moment, is the memory of the part that the Air Force has played in previous coup d'etat in Iraq and the mistrust with which he regards the Air Force as a political instrument, largely because he cannot be sure that the people who are good pilots are necessarily loyal Saddam Hussein supporters. And I think this has always been his dilemma. It's been the dilemma of other presidents and dictators in the Middle East as well. But I think that this is the problem, that you can put your tribesmen in the army, but it's very difficult to make them into very good pilots and then to trust them.
You mean because for a pilot, you really need somebody who's very well trained and is very smart about the technology. You can't just put anybody because they're related to you in that position.
Absolutely. I mean, in order to master the kind of technology you need for modern aerial warfare, you do need people who have a very strong grounding in education. And the chances are in Iraq that these sort of people will come from the educated middle classes, the professional classes of Baghdad, Basra, and so forth. These are not the countrymen of Saddam Hussein. These are not the people from the little villages around Tikrit, the people who would otherwise be agricultural laborers or whatever.
You've said that during the Iran-Iraq War that Saddam Hussein tried to personalize the war as a struggle between the individual rulers of Iraq and Iran. I wonder if you see a parallel in that today in terms of how Saddam Hussein and George Bush talk about the wars.
Oh, well, the way in which Saddam Hussein certainly tries to portray the war, I think it's very important that he does personalize it. But it's not simply a strategy. I think it tells you something about the way he looks at power. I think as far as Saddam Hussein is concerned, power is worthless unless he has personal absolute control of it in Iraq. And so, as one has seen through the cult of personality and the extraordinarily centralized form of command in Iraqi politics, he's done everything he possibly could to ensure that he himself, as the dictator of Iraq, has supreme power. And so in the war against Iran, what he wanted to try and portray, I think, to many Iraqis, was not only that Saddam Hussein was, as it were, protecting them against the rampaging Iranians, but curiously, in a different shift, trying to claim that the Iranians were misled, that they were possibly good Muslims, but they had a madman at their head. And one could see the same kind of rationale taking place in his view of the West, and indeed of the other Arab countries. That is, that if only they were allowed to express themselves, the peoples of the West, the peoples of the Arab countries would all be on Saddam Hussein's side, and it's only their mad leaders which prevent them from expressing themselves and who are determined to prosecute the war against Iraq. So it's partly his way of explaining this war to his people, partly possibly also a kind of vain attempt at subversion beyond his borders, and also possibly tells you something about the way he looks at power.
Now, isn't George Bush personalizing the war, too, in the sense that he's always describing Saddam Hussein as the equivalent of Hitler? We have nothing against the Iraqi people, but Saddam Hussein is a vicious tyrant. Do you think George Bush is also personalizing the war, or do you think he's personalizing it for completely different reasons?
I think he's personalizing it for different reasons. I think that the downside, if you like, of what Saddam Hussein's personalization of power has been is that, of course, he has made it so that he is responsible for everything that happens in Iraq. And therefore, when people look at it from the outside, there's quite clearly an accurate assessment that what Saddam Hussein says goes. And in that sense, the Allies are probably not wrong in personalizing the war. If one can imagine a change of regime in Iraq, one really only has to imagine the removal of Saddam Hussein. And I think as far as the coalition is concerned, they are quite accurate, if you like, in targeting him. So I don't think there's a symmetry, but there's obviously a connection between the two.
Charles Tripp, if you don't mind my asking this, does this war make sense to you?
Well, unfortunately, on one level, it certainly does. That is on the level of Iraqi politics. I think that the decision to invade Kuwait was very much a product of what had been happening in Iraq up to that period since the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And the miscalculations, which led to the outbreak of war, or at least to the unexpected, I believe, as far as Saddam Hussein was concerned, of the outbreak of war on the 16th of January, was very much part and parcel of the way things have been conducted in Iraq, regardless for the moment of what the outside pressures, motives, and so forth were. So what one saw was many ways the intransigence of the Iraqi regime, and to some extent the self-delusion. And I think that those are two very dangerous attitudes with which to approach negotiations when war is the possible outcome. So from the Iraqi point of view, or from the point of view of Saddam Hussein, although I don't think it was inevitable, it was certainly a very strong possibility indeed.
Charles Tripp, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Historian Charles Tripp, he's the co-author of Iran and Iraq at War. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the war today?
Well, we have reports on the missile attack against Tel Aviv and other action in the Persian Gulf. We also have a discussion on today's program about the restrictions under which reporters are operating in Saudi Arabia. I talk with NPR's Mike Schuster in Saudi Arabia, and also with Pete Williams, the Pentagon spokesman. A little back and forth there on the rationale the Pentagon offers for why some information cannot be reported and how that has affected the reporting of Mike and others.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today on TV, we've seen pictures of the latest Scud missile attack on Tel Aviv. John Leonard says while TV is bringing us the action, it's not giving us enough context. John usually reviews books on our show, but he's also a media critic. When I spoke with him earlier today, I asked him what goes through his mind as he watches TV reporters in the Gulf putting on their gas masks, waiting for Scud missiles to fall, and he told me his feelings were complicated.
The lust to be there, the whole danger junkie aspect of foreign correspondents reporting a war that we've seen in movies and read about in books, comes over me when I should know better. I don't really want to be there. I don't want to hear those sirens and distinguish which one's an all clear, which one's a car burglar alarm, and which one means here they come. I deplore that in myself, and yet there's no question that because I find it in myself and because so many of us find it in ourselves, that it was riveting, especially, of course, the first night with the CNN guys in their hotel room reporting, and I couldn't stay away. I couldn't stop. I think that to an important degree, it's gone downhill since, because it's not just that CNN finally lost its four-wire telephone connection and was cut off. It's that certain expectations were raised by the nature of the way television is covering this war, that we would always have some action, that we would always have a picture to look at or a person to talk to live, that we would in fact be able to hold the war in our brains through the miracle of modern electronics. And that clearly isn't true.
One thing I've found is I'm really trying to resist this feeling that the war is a TV show.
and what feeds into the feeling that the war is like a new series for the new season is, if I may use the example of CBS, they've given the war a title. It's called Showdown in the Gulf.
Yep.
It has a theme song. It has a name. It's packaged like a program, not like a news bulletin, not like a special. And I personally feel like it really feeds into this sense that it's a new series, and we'll see what the ratings are.
Well, good television has always been spontaneity, and it's always been live. That's why sports are so exciting. On the other hand, there's a responsibility that television feels to report the world not as a series of accidents, not as a series of fire alarms, but as some sort of coherent narrative story. Now, one of the ways that you do that when you have no coherence, when you don't know the story and you don't know what's going to come out, is to package, is to frame. I don't see how we'll ever escape that aspect of television. And I don't ultimately think it does a grave disservice, except it plays into our formularized responses to television. And we won't have, at the end of the hour, the payoff that we expect, because this is going to be a very long, bloody war. And then the television story will change. Then there will be the question, when these infantry troops go in, and they will have to, because air superiority has not worked. When they go in, it'll be a different television story, and we may not even be able to see it on the screen, because the one thing that the government doesn't want is all of those awful pictures. A lot of people are going to die.
I think in a country that's at war, people really try to continue with their lives to the extent that they can. But I think in a country that is waging war like we are, where the war isn't being carried on in our own country, we're in an odd position. Because, I mean, our bombs are hitting another city. Their bombs are always in jeopardy of hitting people in our allied countries. If we watch TV, we feel like somehow we're there and we're participating, even though what we're doing is basically just watching TV. If we go about our lives, well, you feel kind of guilty. How can you just go about your life when this is happening? And there, I don't know, it seems hard to figure out how to behave in the light of all this.
Well, there it seems to me you might have put your finger on something that is important, is that may be a good thing that television has done, whether it's telling us the whole story or making it coherent or not. It has implicated us in what is going on, because after all, the bombs haven't fallen on us since the American Civil War. It's always been elsewhere. And it is still elsewhere. But if this time we feel that it is closer to home simply because we're part of an electronic web of the information and the bursting of the lights, maybe that is a good thing. Maybe that turns us into a different kind of citizen. I would hope so.
John Leonard, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thanks, Terry.
Media critic and book critic John Leonard. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Shurrock, and Pat Ford. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, more reflections on the war in the Gulf. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.